Good morning, everyone. So we are continuing in our series today called What's in a Name, all about the names of God. We began last week with Jehovah Jireh. God is our provider. Because it was harvest, we started with that. But today we're going right back to the beginning, to the very first name that we see of God in the Bible, back in Genesis chapter 1. And it's the Hebrew word Elohim that we will be focusing on today. But of course, we need our reading, but we're going to do it slightly differently. On Christmas Eve in 1968, three men, Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman, made a radio broadcast where they read the first 10 verses of Genesis chapter 1. The interesting or unique thing about that broadcast was that it was made from the Apollo 8 space shuttle as it orbited the moon for the first time. So we're going to listen to that broadcast now, and then Steve is going to come and continue from verse 11 of chapter 1 on through to the end of the passage, which is chapter 2 and verse 3.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth. And the gathered together of the waters called these seas. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
And the non-astronaut will continue. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times and days and years. And let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds in the sky, and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give you every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Steve. And thank you to Bill and Jim and Frank as well. What a beautiful, powerful, compelling, and evocative passage. One that has resonated down the centuries, meaning so much to so many, including, it seems, to those astronauts on Apollo 8. It is also, of course, a passage that has been at the center of much controversy as our scientific understanding has developed, as we begin to understand more of what happened right at the beginning of the creation of our universe. That scientific understanding has been held in conflict with this biblical passage. Now, today, here in this room, we may have people who believe all sorts of different things about the beginning of the universe. But I want to say I don't see any conflict between the scientific account and the biblical account. And the reason for that is because they are trying to do completely different things. Science, of course, by its very nature, is seeking to understand the scientific, literal, historical account of what happened. And that scientific understanding still has an enormously long way to go. But at the moment, We think that the universe is probably 13.7 billion years old, that our Earth is 4.5 billion years old, that there was some kind of a big bang at the beginning, and that the universe has been expanding ever since. What the Bible passage is trying to do is tell a story. This isn't a scientific, historical account. This is prose, perhaps even poetry. And as I said at the start, it's beautiful and compelling and evocative. It speaks truth into our hearts. Not literal, historical, but truth nonetheless. This is why we have all sorts of different types of literature, because they touch us in different ways. History, science, poetry, prose. We need all of them. And so this passage, I believe, is true, but not literal. In the same way, for example, as Jesus' parables. When he tells the parable of the Good Samaritan, so far as we know, didn't actually exist. And yet, that parable is true because it speaks truth into our hearts, but it's not literal. We might also say the same thing about the book of Job or the book of Jonah. These are stories which help us to understand something. And so this passage in Genesis chapter 1 helps us to understand something about the truth of who God is, something about creation, and something about ourselves. And we're going to delve into that in a bit more detail now. As I said at the beginning, we are continuing today in our sermon series entitled What's in a Name? And many of you will probably recognize where that quote, "What's in a Name?" comes from. It's a soliloquy from Juliet in Romeo and Juliet. She says, "What's in a name? That which we call a rose, by any other name would smell as sweet." I've always wanted to be Juliet, but I've never been cast, which is disappointing. Now, you see, Juliet doesn't think that names matter, particularly those of Montagu and Capulet. The Bible, on the other hand, thinks that names matter very much. Names tell us something about the person involved. And names of God are particularly important. The reason for that is that God is infinite and we are not. And so it is impossible for us to fully comprehend, to fully grasp who God is. And one name certainly wouldn't begin to do him justice. And so, as a way of helping us to build up this jigsaw, this picture of who God is, God has all sorts of names, each of which speak to a particular part of his character. And on top of the specific names of God, we also have a bunch of ways of describing God, metaphors of who God is, things like Father, Shepherd, Lord, King. And so taken all together, these names and these ways of describing God help us to build up a picture, an image of who God is. Of course, it's completely incomplete. It's vastly insufficient. But it at least gives us a chance. And so as we, over the next 6 weeks, look at six different names of God. There are lots more names and ways of describing God in the Bible, but we're going to look at six of them over these next 6 weeks. The idea is that we begin to build up a bit of a picture, putting together all these different aspects of God's character. So last week, because it was harvest, we decided to start with Jehovah Jireh. God is our provider. But today we go right back to the beginning. So we're looking at this name, Elohim. Now, often it's hard for us to tell the different names of God in our English translation because lots of different Hebrew words are simply translated as God in our English versions. So, for example, whenever we see the word God in chapter 1 of Genesis, it's actually the word Elohim. Whenever we see the word God in chapter 2 of Genesis, from verse 4 onwards in chapter 2 of Genesis, that's the word Yahweh. And we're going to be looking at the word Yahweh next week. But today then, Elohim. What does this word Elohim in the context of Genesis chapter 1 tell us about God? I should say, by the way, that Elohim occurs more than 2,500 times in the Bible and in all sorts of different contexts and used in all sorts of different ways, which we don't have time to go into right now. So I'm specifically today looking at what does Elohim in Genesis 1 tell us about God? And the way I want to do that is by looking at two pairs of words. Actually, we could probably do several sermons on this name Elohim, but today I'm just going to focus on two pairs of words. The first pair is powerful and relational. The word Elohim comes from the root word El, which means to be strong or mighty. It also sometimes means to be in front of, which I guess has power when we think about God being, as it were, in front of creation, before creation. But it's particularly this element of strength that I want to think about for a moment. I don't know if you've noticed, but the universe, and I'm going to use a scientific phrase here, is quite big. Our Earth would fit into our sun 1,000,000 times. And our sun is a middling kind of a star. There are 1,000,000,000 stars in our galaxy, and there are billions of galaxies in the universe. It's huge, it's whopping, it's mahoosive. And God created it. God is extraordinarily powerful, mighty, awesome, majestic. This passage in Genesis 1 brings that to life. So we see God flinging stars into space. God is powerful. We believe in a God who is mighty, and I am glad about that. I don't think I'd want to believe in a weakling God. Often, though, for people who are supremely powerful, mighty, majestic, they're also kind of distant and aloof. We can't get close to them. And it might be easy for us to think of a God who created the whole of the universe to be distant, to be somehow separate. And yet nothing could be further from the truth, because God is also innately relational. We see in verses 26 and 27, God creating humanity to be in a relationship with us. That's his desire, that we might be friends with him. What an extraordinary truth. And actually, we are built to be in relationship with one another and also to be in relationship with God. But actually, the fact of God being relational comes even before that. This is going to start to get a bit wacky here, so bear with me. The word Elohim is plural. But it's a plural word used often in a singular context. So the word Elohim is plural. But it's used often singularly. So, for example, in verse 26, we have this, and I want you to listen for the plural words here. So then God, Elohim, said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness." Then, literally the next verse, 27, "So God, Elohim, made mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." So what's going on here? Is God plural or singular? The answer, of course, is both. Confused? Well, welcome to the Trinity. We believe in one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, a triune God, three in one. And it is incredibly difficult for us to understand. But actually, there are some clues which can help us. There are other things which we can think of as being both plural and single. In fact, in the Hebrew language, the language which Genesis and the Old Testament was written in, there are four other words which are plural, but presented in a singular context. And amazingly, three of those words happen in the first verse of Genesis chapter 1. And those words are sky, or skies, or heavens, water, or waters, and face. And perhaps we can begin to understand how those things are both plural and singular. So the sky, the skies, the heavens, we can kind of work out how that's sort of plural and singular. Water, for me, that's a good one. I can definitely grasp the fact how water is both plural and singular. It's kind of one thing, but also made up of lots of tiny things. And face, well, I guess our face is one thing, but comprised of lots of different parts, ears and nose and mouth and so on. So there are ways that we could begin to understand things which are both plural and singular. And it's nice of God to slip that in right at the beginning of Genesis chapter 1, to then help us to understand something of what we're understanding when we read this word Elohim. So God is three in one, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And what that means is that God, by his very nature, is relational. He is, as it were, in relationship with himself, and then desperate to be in relationship with us too. So an essential part of God is that he is both mighty and powerful and awesome, but also present, engaged, relational. I think that's pretty extraordinary. Okay, that's our first pair of words. Our second pair of words is that God is creative and orderly. Now, those are two words that we don't often put together, do we? We often think of creative types as being a bit chaotic. Have you ever been into an artist's studio? It's usually absolutely mayhem. We might think of creativity and chaos being partners. We might also, some of us, think of orderliness and boredom being partners. And yet God manages to combine creativity and orderliness together. Now this week, when we were reading this passage in our staff meeting, we finished it, and Clive, our curate here, just did a big sigh and went, "Oh, I just find it such a relief to know that God is a project manager." You can take the man out of the civil service. And I looked at it, I was completely baffled. So for Clive, this kind of orderliness had really touched him and made him feel such a sense of relief, whereas I'd been thinking of it just reflecting on God's outrageous creativity, thinking of God as some kind of, I don't know, bebop jazz saxophonist or something. And it was really interesting that the two of us picked up on different things that made us excited about this passage. But what I want to say is that God is both of those things. The word Elohim actually is innately linked to creation and to creativity. And yet, as we read the passage, it's also incredibly ordered and structured. And so, and we're back to metaphors here, I don't know how this one's going to land, to be honest, but I think God is a bit more like Pep Guardiola. Or perhaps Pep Guardiola is a bit like God. So for those of you who don't know anything about football, Pep Guardiola is the preeminent manager of this generation. And his teams are incredibly well structured. They practice and practice down to the nth degree. They know exactly where they should be at any given moment. They work on patterns that kind of move up and down the pitch. When the ball is in one area of the pitch, every player on that team knows exactly where they should be. And yet in the midst of that orderliness and structure, There is also room for outrageous creativity. Players like Bernardo Silva and Phil Foden and Kevin De Bruyne play beautiful football. And Man City, with all the caveats about ownership and money buying football and all that kind of stuff, they're a joy to watch. And actually, even for me as a blind person, they're a joy to listen to. I can picture this orderly creativity going on the pitch. And so I think there's something of that being reflected here. God is ridiculously creative. I mean, this passage evokes it beautifully. And look around at creation. Mountains and mongoose and sunrises and axolotls and nebulas. I don't know if any of you have seen the Cat's Eye Nebula. It's if you don't know what a nebula is, it's a big shiny thing in space. So I think it's gas, maybe. I don't really know. But it's unbelievable. The Cat's Eye Nebula is just ridiculously beautiful. And it's, I don't know, billions of miles from anywhere else. God created it just for the pure joy of creativity. Even now, it's been 12 or 13 years since I could see it to look at, but I can still picture it so clearly in my mind's eye. God is outrageously, wonderfully, gloriously creative. But he is also well-ordered and structured. This poem has a structure to it, the first day, the second day, the third day. There's an order to creation, and that is also, I think, reassuring. So God is not only powerful and mighty and also relational, but he is gloriously creative without the chaos and wonderfully ordered without the boredom that we might associate with that. So that's something of what Elohim tells us about God. What then does this passage tell us about ourselves? In verse 27 or 28, God looks at humanity and says, "Very good." So here's the thing this morning. No matter how messed up or broken or screwed up you feel, no matter how ashamed or guilty or embarrassed, no wonder how confused or faithless or separate or isolated, no matter how hurt or fearful you are, the God of power and relationship, of creativity and order, the God who made the whole universe looks at you and says, "You are very good." God looks at you with love and pride. So, Juliet asked, "What's in a name?" I wonder, what's your answer to that this morning?